So we're back with episode 20 of Dialed In with Jake and Zach, and we'll get started here in just a few moments after a word with our good friends at Law Chevrolet.
Hey guys, it's Dylan here at Law Chevrolet Buick. Man, what an amazing year it was. 2018 was truly awesome. The support that we had from our drag racing community was tremendous. Whether it was coming and purchasing a vehicle from us or sending somebody in that you knew or even making sure that you got your service work done here. Guys, we truly appreciate that. With that being said, we're going to continue what we did in 2018. If you're part of our drag racing community and you come and purchase a vehicle from us, we're going to give you $600 on a Visa gift card. It could be used for whatever you want it to be used for. If you're like me, that's some buyback money. So like I said, we appreciate everything you guys have done for us in 2018. Let's make 2019 a great year again. Make sure to give me a call here at 812-897-2220 or just visit lawchevy.com. We'd be glad to take care of you guys. Thank you.
Here we go, staging them up on the left-hand lane. The Throwdown Motorsports 65 Chevy 2. 626 on the dial, it's Zach Slump. On the right-hand side, the Icon Pistons Diamond Engine and Machine 74 Vega Wagon. 592 on the dial, it's Jake Hodge.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, one and all, episode 220. In honor of this episode with being number 20, we'll just kind of dedicate it. Well, not dedicate it, but we're going to say it's in honor of Mr. Tony Stewart, Smoke, always my favorite NASCAR racer. When he was in the 20, yeah, he was in the 14 for a while too, but you know, those years when he was in the 20 was a lot of fun watching him do good. And Jake, being a dirt track racer as well from Indiana, you could appreciate Smoke, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. He lives just about 30 miles east of me in Columbus. I actually want to go visit his new business venture. He's just had a 400-acre fenced-in hunting ground, so he takes people on hunting excursions and stuff. So
nice.
Should be pretty cool. He was in very good disguise at PRI. I walked right past him and said, that was Tony. He had the mullet and bifocals and a hat pulled down real low. It's pretty funny, but... Awesome. Yeah, he has been number 14 for a while, since like 2009, but you know, he was way more young and dumb in the 20 car. Is pretty cool, but yeah. Has your 5K win sank in yet? Or have you blown it all? What's going on?
Yeah, I guess a little bit. Yeah, I spent some of it.
A little bit. You blown it all, or a little bit it sank in?
Well, yeah, it sank in. It was still an awesome night that night. And yeah, I've spent some of it, not all of it yet. You know, got a pre-entry or two paid out of there, and a few parts definitely helped out with the engine build. And so we're moving forward on that. Everything's going well. I got the short block put together this weekend, so that was some really good progress. And then so I should have the rest of the motor together. I just talked to Luke Siebert at Siebert Performance. He said my carburetor is going to be on the way here soon. So, man, I'm getting excited. I mean, besides for it being like 0 degrees here in Indiana a couple of days, but, you know, right beyond that, the racing season's not too far away. Really starting to get the itch and get ready to go. How about you?
Yeah, I don't have enough time in the day, I don't think. But yeah, my engine's about put together at Diamond Engine and Machine. I don't know what else I got left. I've kind of put it on the back burner. I've got 1,800 other things to do. But we did have some bracket racing over the weekend. The King of the Coast Series down at Gulfport, if you're from Indiana, or Gulfport, if you're from Mississippi, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard about 13 different ways, but I'll run through the top bulb results if you want to hit the bottom bulb and sportsman stuff, because you know, I probably couldn't hit the bottom of you when I was reading it off the screen. So the Friday gambler winner, a dude that is a bad unit whenever he drives Josh Ray Chevy 2, John Claxton, the Friday gambler winner. Him and Josh Ray ventured down that way from, I think, Ardmore, Alabama area is where Josh lives. It's actually Holly Ray Chevy 2 now. His wife took claim to it. Saturday, the main event winner in electronics was Chad Axford over Travis Lipscomb. Sunday, Tommy Castanedo over Alan Wickel. Alan was the first B&M Series champion, and he's still out here doing work in 2019. Semifinalist, little guy, not very well known, Johnny Zell, getting the semifinal on Sunday in the King of the Coast electronics category.
Oh, Ezel. Yeah, okay. Ezel.
Yeah,
I got it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I haven't heard that name very much.
Yeah.
Foot brake results. Saturday, Larry Seguin, I'm going to go with, took the win in over Robbie Mullins. And the semi was Cody Barnhart. And Saturday results for sportsman, Jerry Rogers, took the win over Nikki Wenzel. And the semifinalist was Tony Diagnolo. And in footbreak on Sunday, the win was Timmy Fieramusca. Runner-up, Robbie Mullins. I don't know if you heard that right, but yeah, two finals for Mr. Mullins. So drilling them in the footbreak category every round but the final. That's awesome. And semi on in footbreak on Sunday was Nick Trapani. And in sportsman, the win was Nikki Wenzel. On Sunday, runner-up Louis Diagnolo, or Lewis, however he pronounces it. Hannah Bailey was in a semi with Gene Allen.
I think it's D'Angelo, but I see where you get Diagnolo.
Oh, from. D'Angelo, that is, my bad.
That is a very well-known name in the winner's column of bracket races. But yeah, I see that.
I somehow put a consonant in there that didn't even exist. It's kind of tired on a Monday night. Sorry about that.
If it was easy, everybody would do it, right?
This is true.
The Pooh Poohs Turkey Day Footbreak 10K. Hayden Miller. Yeah, that's awesome. That's an awesome name for a race. Mm-hmm. And I think it's at Gulfport every year. But Hayden Miller getting it done Saturday and Sunday in the 8 and 9 year old category. The runner up Saturday was Lindley Hatcher and Kane Kern on Sunday. Rollison's Firestone Junior Dragster, 10 to 12. Lane Lewis won on Sunday. Riley Wells won Saturday. And let's see, 13 to 17, Colton Fuller and Jacob Hickey are your winners Saturday and Sunday. Rebecca, we're going to say it's spelled two different ways on this. By the way, shout out to Galen Rollison and the King of the Coast BTE Flyers. They're the nice put together winners and losers, easy to find. Mm-hmm. That's pretty awesome. But I'm going to say Rebecca Goudry. That's what we're going with. Mm-hmm. She was in the late rounds both days. So shout out to Rebecca. Yeah, I've never ventured down that way for the King of the Coast race, but it seems to be an ever popular event in the early parts of the year.
Yeah, it looked like a good race, and I saw a couple time slips from down there, and apparently the top dragster guys were playing around at this race. I saw one guy was down four flat, and then somebody was saying, he said, man, that takes a brave fellow to run down that lane that fast. And somebody said, well, you should have seen a few pairs before him. A guy went 390. Crazy. But yeah, that's awesome.
I've bracket raced 420, and that's plenty. I don't need to go 390.
Yeah, I remember when I ran Bob Mandel at Etheridge, he was dialed 409, and that was about the fastest I've ever been passed. That was the fastest I've ever been passed in my life. I was lucky my wind light come on, but I tell you what, it was cool. The chute came out, and sparks flew when it hit the track. When the springs hit the track, and it was a very interesting view to have at see somebody slow down at US 43 that was going up 170 whatever miles an hour.
US 43 is not a quarter mile track, nor is it a lengthy shutdown track. So that's definitely a track that you need to have everything go right whenever you let off the loud pedal. So we're gonna hear from our friends at the Practice Tree who are gonna come up on February 23rd. We're gonna hear from them just for a quick moment, and we'll be right back with our big interview.
Saturday, February 23rd, the return of the biggest little practice tree race in the land, the In Motion Solutions Practice Tree Hootenanny, presented by Jim Feaster Racing, featuring the best and baddest practice tree drag racing on this side of the Mississippi. The Loose Rocker Promotions Animal Eliminator guaranteeing $3,000 to the winner and a free weekend entry to the St. Patrick's Classic at Virginia Motorsports Park. The Adams Racing Big Dog Shootout makes its debut, giving away a K&N Spring Fling Million Weekend Package valued at over $2,600 to the winner in the 64-entry field. For the Bottom Bulbers, the World Footbreak Challenge Bottom Bulb Blitz makes its return with a $1,000 payday going to the last man standing and a weekend entry to the World Footbreak Challenge at Bristol Dragway. 782 Township Road 101 in West Salem, Ohio, just 3 miles south of Dragway 42. Gates open at 1, racing at 4. Come on back to the biggest little practice tree race in the land, the In Motion Solutions Practice Tree Hootenanny, presented by Jim Feaster Racing. Be there!
So joining us today is the two-time NHRA World Champion, the 2015 U.S. Nationals winner in Supercomp, the 2017 Spring Fling Million winner, co-host of the Sportsman Drag Racing Podcast with Luke and Jed, the sole proprietor of Luke Bogacki Motorsports, if you don't ask Jessica, that is. And this is Bracket Racing Elite, Luke Bogacki. How's it going, man?
Wonderful, guys. Man, thank you for having me on. This is cool. I'm on a racing podcast, and I'm being interviewed, not interviewed. interviewing, so I'm digging it.
Man, we are excited to have you. Glad to have you on the show. Thank you very much for joining us. And so I know a lot of our listeners are going to be familiar, but I'm sure there still are some out there that are not. If you would just kind of give us an overview of your path through your racing career.
Yeah, the guys that just got off dial-up internet, the guys that just caught up with the podcast thing, let them know who Luke Bogacki is.
Right.
It started for me like it did for, I think, for both of you guys and for probably the wide majority of your listeners. Like, I got into racing because my dad raced. And I just remember from a real young age, if he ever went to the racetrack without me, I would have been, I didn't know about it because I would have been really upset. Like, to just had a passion for it for as long as I can remember, been around it, watched him racing. I think I was 11 years old when NHRA introduced the Junior Dragster program, and I hounded him enough about it for long enough that I had one shortly thereafter, and did that for a couple of years, had a little bit of success, and then started working at the racetrack and saved up my money and actually bought my own. I got to give myself credit for that. I bought like a $2,500, huge investment for a 14-year-old, Nova, and which was a bucket. I mean, you just got to see pictures of it to believe it. It was pretty rough, as you might imagine, and kind of got started from there, and it's just snowballed. And I don't know, never would have dreamed at that point that it would have taken me to where it's taken me, but racing has been really good to me. You guys reeled off some of the on-track accomplishments, and that spawned into several side businesses, including thisisbracketracing.com, and ultimately led to the Sports and Drag Racing podcast and everything that we're involved in now. But when you look back on all of that and kind of say it in one breath like that, it's been a heck of a ride.
Yeah, and you know, I was kind of skimming through the This Is Bracket Racing about, you know, and you're much like David Bird Jones. You know, he's won every bracket race he's ever entered, but you won the first one you ever entered.
This is true. It's actually a cool story. I still feel like it's like my claim to fame. I won the first ever junior dragster race at Texas Raceway, which was also my first ever junior dragster race, and I believe was the case for the other seven racers entered. I mean, we were all completely green, completely new, and I would love to say that I was just unbeatable that day, but I still have the times. I think my best light was 720 when, you know, 500 was good. It just happened to be better than the three guys that I raced. And then to fast forward it a couple of years, when I was 14 and we got my Nova done, my father and Wendell Dunaway, a couple other friends, had raced it at Kennedale at our home track, which there, you know, they had rules like you actually had to have a driver's license to race, so I couldn't race there, and everybody knew how old I was. But my father had made me a deal at some point that he would take me to the local outlaw track. I say local, it was a little ways away. It was actually Bird's home track. I don't want to name names. I don't guess I can get him in trouble now, 20 years ago, right? I went to Cedar Creek Dragway when I was 14, and for like a test and tune day, and my father, which I still don't understand now, you know, 25 years later, that he made me this bet that I wouldn't be 5-something on the tree all day. And I had run juniors for 2 years, and like I spent more time on the practice tree than anybody in the world. So whatever, I was like, I'll be five something the first hit. So I got my $20 or something off of him, and but I made whatever 10-15 runs that day, and I didn't hit anything, and I didn't look like an idiot, and they didn't tell me I couldn't race. So then I hounded my dad until he actually took me on a bracket trip, or, you know, took me to race at a regular bracket race. And I went in feeling like, you know, cock of the walk, like I'm just going to run over all these fools and I'm going to win this race. And I got, you know, pretty good dose of humble pie immediately. I think my third round I was out in both classes, and we were loading up to leave, and they announced that they were going to have a consolation race, which don't let the years since let me inflate the story behind this, because I want to say there was like 5 or 6 cars that entered it, but I did win. So technically, yeah, I won my first junior dragster race, and I won the first day that I raced in a big car. So how's that?
Very impressive. Well, Luke, you know, now, I mean, you started out and you got on the Big Money Bracket Racing Tour, which you were very successful, literally hundreds of Big Money Bracket Racing wins. And, you know, now as evolution of life tends to go, you find yourself, you know, in a family with, you know, with Jessica and your two boys, Gary and Jack. So how do you find the balance in your life now between the family and the racing?
That's a good question, because it's tough. I think it's something that, to, at least to some extent, all of us struggle with, because I don't care what it is that you do for a living. Like I just think it's the modern struggle that I'm not the only one that when I am at work, you know, and for me for a lot of years, like racing was work. There is at least a portion of me that feels guilty that I'm not spending time with my wife or with my children. And then on the flip side of that, when you get that quality time, time. Like, there is at least a portion of me that feels guilty that I'm not applying myself wholeheartedly to my craft, you know, to become the best that I can be. And that's like a walking contradiction that it just seems like there's always a sense of guilt that follows you around. And I think for me recently, I feel like I've made big strides in that area, that at least I'm aware of that guilt and try to kind of reconcile it. But I think a big advantage for me as I kind of can kind of step back from it and look at it is it wasn't really by plan, but I had kids a little bit later in life than most. Like, I was 31 when Gary was born. I'm 37 now. I'll be 38 in a couple of months. And we just had our youngest 7 months ago. And I think, again, while it wasn't planned, when I look back on it, I was able to kind of sow a lot of my wild oats and pursue a lot of those crazy dreams that just wouldn't have been, I don't say wouldn't have been possible, like it just wouldn't have been feasible, like smart, to just go drop everything and go racing 40 weekends a year if I had, you know, a 6-month-old at home. So, right. and having the opportunity to have done that, like, I wouldn't say that I don't still have a passion for racing and still have goals to pursue and things like that. But I'm to a point in my racing specifically that if for whatever reason I could never stage another car, like, I'm pretty confident that I would look back and say, man, that was really awesome. And I accomplished more than I ever would have dreamed of and did everything that I wanted to do. So kind of having that out of the way, so to speak, before I really started a family, I think allows me a little bit of perspective to really, I feel like, put them first. And I do that a lot now. And that's a part of the reason. It's actually funny. Last year, we drew back a lot on our racing schedule, which I was completely fine with, like, between family time and just, like, I've been so immersed in it for so long that it's kind of cool to enjoy other things in life and business obligations, everything else. Like, I've got a lot of new challenges that I don't miss the competition aspect as much as you would think. But it's funny now, after a year of that, my wife and my 5-year-old are like, Daddy, when are we going racing? So we're going to go racing a little bit more in 2019.
So shifting back to the on-track segment of it, you know, it's very easy. I know Kenny Underwood tells Troy Williams all the time, Troy, it takes 30 seconds of focus and then you can do whatever you want. So what do you do if you temporarily lose track of focus and or get caught up in what's going on in the other lane, if that ever happens? I mean, I'm sure it happens quite a bit with the different games people try to play, but what do you do to kind of just pull yourself back to the earth level and say, hey, you know, this is my job and this is how I have to execute it?
Sure. No, and that is a complete Underwoodism. That is a great a great tribute to him, is, you know, like, look, you're making this way too hard. And I think in large part for me, kind of getting to that space, like, I guess I'd break it up. You talked about more on track. For me, it's like pre-race, kind of getting into that zone. For me, it's all about routine and just the idea that for the most part, my routine, like, say, from the water box on, but even like, I'm really regimented about suiting up and kind of when I suit up and kind of getting that quiet time. Because once you put the helmet on, it's, for the most part, that's kind of an unspoken rule. Like, people just don't bother you. So particularly when I kind of get overwhelmed at the track, which is something that I can fight, you know, between whether it's customers or elite members or just people wanting to talk, like, it can be difficult to kind of get that zone quiet time. So I'll maybe put my helmet on earlier in some cases when I need to compartmentalize. Like, look, I just need 5 minutes to shut everything off. But for me, the routine is a huge part of it, because for the most part, like, I have altered very little of what I do in the car for probably 10 plus years. So with that, obviously, there is a comfort in kind of doing the same thing over and over and over. And specific me, like, no matter what the situation or what the stakes, like, I can find a lot of confidence in just kind of taking that deep breath and saying, okay, I'm going to do exactly what I did last round, which is the same thing that I did at this race a year ago, which is the same thing that I've done, you know, maybe 10,000 times in my life. Like, I don't need to make it any harder right now. So that's a big thing for me. And then specific to, like, if you're going to get a little bit in the weeds, like, 8th mile bracket racing, to me, it's changed so much over the course of the last decade. And our cars are so much better than they ever were before that, like, I just don't get caught up in a lot of the downtrack game, because for the most, with little exception, I have a really good idea of what I'm going when I stage. And if I get confused at all, like, I just try to put it on. You know what I mean? And I know that sounds way oversimplified, but I'm like, okay, he's not where I expected him to be at all over there. But, like, don't get caught up in that. Like, I can go whatever, you know, 5,000ths under, 15,000ths under. Like, just kill 5 or 15,000ths and hope for the best.
Yeah,
and
I don't think. Go
ahead. No, I was just saying, like, that sounds really dumb, because there are times, with complete honesty, like, I'll go through the finish line and you could ask me who got there first. Like, I don't know. Like, he wasn't where I was supposed to be. And I knew he had to do something, and I wasn't wanting to get caught up in that. And I just tried to go dead on. So, yeah. You know.
And it's not like, you know, Mikey Bloomfield has a low air bottle in the other lane because, you know, he starts ripping at 60 foot and sprays for 400 foot on. It's easy to get caught up in something like that, I understand. But yeah, that's probably the best game plan, I would think. You know, I'm just kind of behind the times. I'm not this is Bracket Racing Elite member yet, so maybe in the near future.
So yeah, and with the mentioning this is Bracket Racing, so, you know, Luke, obviously there's been a lot of changes, and, you know, from where This Is Bracket Racing started, and, you know, the old thisisbracketracing.com days to now, you know, This Is Bracket Racing Elite. So just kind of, you know, tell us a little bit about the evolution of This Is Bracket Racing from where it started to where it is today.
Jake, that was like a professional transition there. So you guy like me, I can appreciate that.
I wish I could say it was planned. I really could.
Switch, you know, it right into the This Is Bracket Racing. It was good. No, it's wild. It's kind of, Zach, it's similar to when I look back on my racing career and like where it started to where it is, and how you just can't, even with the best of intentions, like can't forecast where things are going. Like I never would have dreamt that I would be able to have the platform that we do and just kind of spend most of my days teaching people how to race or helping people become better racers. It's pretty cool because all of this started with a friend of mine, good friend of mine named Blake Allen. Blake lives in Oklahoma and used to do really, really good bracket racing when I was a kid. And then life kind of took over and family obligations. And he's been, I don't want to say in and out of the sport, but in and out of the driver's seat quite a bit since. But he hounded me for a couple of years. And this is back in like mid 2000s. Hey, you need to put on a driving school. Like, look, that's not me. And B, like, ain't nobody going to pay to listen to me tell them about racing. Like, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. Right. And he kept on and kept on and kept on. And finally, one day he's like, look, I got 10 guys together that want to pay, that want you to come put on a class. You got to come do it. And I'm okay. Well, I'll do that. Right. And I was really nervous about it and I didn't know what I was getting into. And keep in mind too, you know, I mean, I had had some success at that point, but I'm 25 years old, you know, I mean, not to say that I know it all now, but I certainly wasn't confident of it. And I get in a room with these guys and we did like a, you know, it was a seminar type format, you know, or a presentation for a day. And then I think we went to the racetrack for a day. And I was just amazed at how well it went and how receptive those racers, that original group, you know, those 10 guys and girls that were in there, that, you know, obviously they paid to listen to what I had to say and how receptive they were to it. And then what was really cool was the next day taking it to the racetrack and actually visually watch them implement some of the things that we talked about and improve on the racetrack. And I thought, man, this is really cool. Like, not only did it go better than I thought, like I got more out of it than I thought, you know, from a personal standpoint. And it just kind of snowballed from there. That ballooned into a number of live schools for several years. And then I thought, okay, how can I don't know, like scale is something that's a part of my vocabulary now. It wasn't in 2008, but it was, how can I take this and impact more racers more easily? And the internet was obviously the answer with thisisbracketracing.com. And that morphed along and took a couple of different turns and phases. And then the This Is Bracket Racing Elite deal, Zach, was just a complete accident. I mean, how this all started was it three winters ago, we did the off-season practice tree challenge, which is actually something that's about to start again in a couple weeks. It's a public Facebook group. You're welcome to join, anybody that's listening. It's the This Is Bracket Racing off-season practice tree challenge. And within that, I just kind of outlined like, hey, this is how I practice specifically during the off-season, but, you know, every week. And this is how I get better. And I just outlined, you know, 10 of my favorite exercises. And by the end of that 2-week period in, what was that, early 2016, I guess, this Facebook group had like 2,500 followers. And literally, it seemed like 1,000 of them were participating and sharing the results every day. And I was blown away by the interaction on it. And I just thought, okay, like, we've got this following, like, we have to be able to do something with it. And what that became was sort of a beta group for This Is Bracket Racing Elite, because at the end of it, I said, hey, if there's a ton of you in here that are participating in this, if there are 20 of you that would be willing to, you know, pay like a monthly fee to work one-on-one with me, and we'll try this for the rest of the year. You know, like, there's no commitment, you know, 1 month at a time, but I'll commit to this for the rest of the year if you guys want to try it, and we'll see how it goes. And it was originally, I think, Zach, you may have even been a part of it at the time, from the get-go, like, it was just those 20 people. And it was really cool to, it gave me the opportunity to kind of feel out how to present things in the online space and work really closely with just a handful of racers. And that's what we did for the better part of a year. And then we opened the doors of that to what has now become This Is Bracket Racing Elite. And the membership has gone nuts. And we help hundreds of racers from really all across North America. And if you had told me that 3 years ago, I'd been like, what? But it's amazing the following that it's got and the impact I feel like that we're having.
And that's kind of a thing that, you know, I respect out of you is I know you temporarily closed the gates on Elite for a little while, right? Because you don't want it to get so big that you can't take the time and help somebody if they have an issue, right?
It has grown monumentally, and it did. It got to a point where it was a little bit overwhelming. So what we've done is we had an open enrollment period where anybody could sign up through mid-December, and then we've closed the doors since, with the idea being twofold. Like, A, number one, it has grown so much so quickly that, like, we kind of need to get a handle on it and make sure that we serve our members first and foremost before we go try and do attract new ones. And then at the same time, like, it's not like it's the last time that we'll open the doors. We'll have another open enrollment period here within a couple of months probably. But I just like the idea from a business standpoint of, okay, with an open enrollment period, I can focus on marketing our group and basically recruiting new members for a week. And then I can spend whatever it is, 3, 4, 6 months just catering to our members and making awesome content and making sure that they're getting the most out of this experience. So that's really the reason for it more than anything. It allows us to kind of pool our resources and say, okay, for this specific time period, we're going to market. Okay, that's over. Now we're just going to deliver value.
Right. And you could be, you know, another guy and saying, oh yeah, more money. Let's go. And that's not what it's about. And that's not what you're about. And that's one thing I respect greatly. Back over to the racetrack side, you've done it both in Super Comp and Super Gas. I know your first one's probably more memorable, but can you give us kind of a few distinctions out of each one of them and maybe which one was your favorite and why?
As far as the championship years?
Yep.
I mean, they're obviously both unique and really special to me when I look back at them. The Super Gas season was unreal just because of, like, the points total. I mean, it was Trevor Larson finished second that year, and TJ, Troy Coughlin Jr., finished third. And any other year, either of them would have won the championship. Like, we both had, or all three had incredible, like, 700 plus point seasons, or real close to 700 maybe for them. So that's special, but I don't think anything would ever top Super Comp for a couple reasons. Number one, it was first, you know what I mean? And at that point, I'd had some near miss. So winning the championship, I mean, it's important to everybody that's ever, you know, even thought about trying it, you know, to win it. But especially for me, having come so close, I'd been second and third up to that point, to actually seal it. And to me, to do it in 890, especially, not that Super Comp's any tougher than Super Gas. I mean, they're different animals, but I think they're equally difficult to win. But I grew up watching Scotty and Edmund and Tommy Phillips. And even if you go back a little further than that, you know, Steve Cohen, guys like that, like, to me, that was always, I don't want to say it's maybe not fair to say it was the pinnacle of the sport, but it was what I looked up to, because when I was growing up, the best racers were in that category. And it's always been a class, and still is a class, that there's so much more room for creativity and driving style. And you know what I mean? Like, you're just not going to set it on 90 and hold it on the floor and win. Like, you have to drive both ends of the racetrack and come at it with a unique strategy and be able to strategize in that idea, in that way, and also execute. Like, I think winning a championship in that category, for whatever reason, whether it's right or wrong, I set a little notch above any other.
And while we're on that topic, give us something that nobody really puts into realization whenever you're going to run for a world championship. Because, you know, a win light when you're coming through fourth round means a whole bunch for championship standings at the end of the year, even if you're in April. So kind of just give us a little rundown of, you know, what it really takes from a guy that's driven to Salt Lake City to hit a divisional.
There's so much unique about it, because for one thing, like, I think it's really easy for the regular bracket racer to look at NHRA Live Timing or Drag Race Central or something like that and say, my God, I could do. Because typically, specifically in the 90 categories, the packages are much sloppier than what we're used to seeing in an eighth mile bracket race, right? Typically, like, if you can be 20 total in Super Comp, I mean, there's exceptions to the rule, but that's a pretty solid run. And if you go take your 20 total to the $1 million race, like, you may not win around for 5 days, you know? But
I do know.
Right, don't we all? But it's a different animal. I mean, A, it's quarter mile, so everything gets spread out a little bit more. B, you bring the fixed index and throttle stops into the equation. So even if you know, hey, it's 500s faster than our last run, it's not like you can just dial down 5. Like, you have to figure out how to get back to the index. So there's more variables there. And then specifically at the national event level, I mean, it's not uncommon to run around like 36 hours after the last round, and the DA is 2,000 feet different, and the wind's blowing 20 mile an hour in an opposite direction, and you got to try to come up with some semblance of a game plan for that. You know what I mean? So there's a lot that goes into it. It's definitely sloppier, quote unquote, but that's because it's more difficult for everybody to make good runs. So that's a big part of it. It's just a different mindset in general. And then specific to chasing points, like, I just don't think you realize until you go through it. And we did a series on our podcast over the winter where we interviewed, I think we touched on every national champion. I interviewed all the NHRA guys, and Jed interviewed the bracket champions and the IHRA world champions. And a constant question for me was like, just explain the logistics of making enough races, because we're a little bit spoiled where we are, you know, here in the Midwest. Like, if you wanted to run NHRA racing, there's not an immense amount of travel with it. It's still committing to 14 weekends, and the woes and ups and downs of kind of the roller coaster ride of chasing point. But specifically, like, for the West Coast guys, or the East Coast guys, like, just making 14 races, I mean, you could log 20,000-30,000 miles just to get to the events, you know?
Ron Foster drove to Vegas.
Right, exactly. And to your point, like, a couple years ago, the last time that I kind of got involved in a points chase, that was it was 2017, right? Yeah.
Yep.
And I started the season with no intentions of chasing points at all. I was just going to go to a handful of national events. And I think through the first four that I went to, I had two wins and a runner-up. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, wow, you know, like, that's a really good score. Maybe I should go to some points meets. And the problem with that was it was August. And so
Justin Lamb, is that you?
Yeah, right. Justin went through the same thing last year. So the next thing you know, that takes me to, I leave Dallas and drive to Salt Lake City for a doubleheader. And then ended up, you know, it was closer than it looked at the end on paper. I had an opportunity going into Noble, and Austin Williams shut the door to me when he won that race. And I think I ended up fourth. But no, I mean, there's just that one I made harder on myself than it has to be. But it is a grind. I mean, you'd think just 14 races doesn't sound like that big a deal. But when you include the travel and just the idea that it is, with few exception, one race a weekend. And like, if you get bounced first round, you're not buying back. You know what I mean? It's one shot a weekend. Like, it is. It's mentally, physically, financially taxing. Like, it's just hard.
And real quick, back to your comment on the bracket racer looks at these packages. You know, I've been in that. I've always said I've wanted to run a 90 something card just so I can tell myself it's not that easy. I get it. And there's no way that I know it's not that easy at all. And you know, I've never really talked down upon it because I can't try it. I haven't yet. I could either be a 130 mile an hour super gas car or hang 500 pounds on my Vega and run super streets. So
yeah, no, it is. I mean, you may not be willing to say it, but I did. You know, in the mid 2000s, when I was just bracket racing all the time, I'm like, that doesn't even look like a challenge. I ain't gonna go run super gun. That's easy. And then you get a quick taste of it that, okay, like, this can make you look really stupid really quick. You know what I mean? Because it's really hard. So, and I think I'm in the minority. I enjoy kind of the mental gymnastics of that and the challenge of it, just because, and granted, I feel like it gives me a little bit of an edge now, particularly because I've been doing that type of racing for, you know, a decade. But I do feel like the more you spread things out and the more variables there are that I discussed earlier, like, I just think it magnifies the difference between the experienced and the inexperienced, the prepared and the unprepared, and then probably more than anything, like, the confident and the unconfident. And I feel like that gives me an edge that I don't necessarily have bracket racing.
Well, shifting gears over to another aspect of the sport that you've been very successful with and worked very hard at over the years, and that's the marketing side of racing. In your experience, I mean, can you give our listeners maybe a top thing or maybe a top three things that that they could do to start helping themselves be better positioned to gain themselves a marketing partner?
Okay, if I was going to break that into three things, I think the first, and it's the most obvious to me, and it's the thing that I think most of us struggle with the most, is that best way to put this, like, no one's going to build your platform, and to some extent, like, for me, when I was coming up, that was making sure that everyone realized when I had success, right? And that can come across really easily as just you're tooting your own horn. And in this day and age, like, I don't even know that that's necessary, because the results are out there so much more than they used to be. And social media, like, will almost toot your own horn for you. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to let everybody know every time that you lay down 5,000s total, right? Like, just, it happens more organically, I guess. But what I would encourage you to do is, like, figure out a way that you can add value. Like, whether that is just simply telling your story that people can consume. Like, that's what I did for years with DragRaceResults.com and our On the Road column. And I got so much interaction and following from that, like, still to this day, that people just enjoyed reading about that because it was real. Like, it was something that they could empathize with. Like, we've all been through those situations where, like, it's all you can do just to get to the racetrack without the wheels running off the tow vehicle. You know what I mean? Much less actually competing. Whatever that is. That you specifically can add value. Maybe that is, you know, sharing your experiences. Maybe that is teaching people, like in my case, you know, like how to become a little bit better racer, take better, take strides in that area. Maybe it's on the mechanical end. You understand the inner workings of a transmission. Like, explain that. Show people that. Like, that's to me what social media is for. Not to necessarily toot your own horn. It is to provide value in a unique way and build a following. Because ultimately, that's what marketing partners are interested in. Like, they don't care that you won 10 races last year. They care about how many people can you influence to purchase their product or their service, or at least expose to their name. And then if you take that, like, a little bit further, maybe whatever it is that you kind of develop that niche for, maybe that in and of itself becomes an opportunity to profit, you know, not necessarily from racing, but surrounding it. Maybe you become that transmission builder, or maybe you just become the people that the guy that tells other people how to build transmission. Regardless, it starts by building that platform, and you can't be afraid to, like I always said, don't be afraid of self-promotion. And like I said, I think that's changed a little bit. Like, you don't want to just beat people over the head with, I'm so good at whatever X, but think about how you can provide value and then go provide value and build that following. I think that that's probably the biggest thing. And then, like, I think I'm just going to give you two, Zach, because that's the resounding one. The second for me would be in whatever it is that you do, whether it is, you know, a marketing partnership, you know, sponsorship type relationship, or whether it is, you know, going into business somehow around racing and dealing with customers. Either way, that stuff's based on relationships. Okay, that's all a marketing agreement is. That's all a sponsorship is. It's a relationship between you and as a racer and that company. And typically, it comes down to your relationship with a couple of individuals, maybe one individual, depending on the size of the company, right? And how well you can return on their investment really comes down to how well you can communicate with them. What do they need, and how can you help them get there? Because the days, if we're going to talk in terms of sponsorship, the days of saying, I'm going to slap a decal on my car and all of these racers and all of these fans are going to see it and that's worth X amount of money. That's not worth anything, okay? When it becomes worth money for that marketing partner is when you can take specific racers and bring them to them and say, okay, these are potential customers. And it's when you can convert those potential customers and say, here's a guy that is really interested in this product because you make it and because I run it and because I've told them how awesome it is, right? Or I'm driving people towards this service. Like, that's ultimately what's tangible, right? You have to actually provide, bottom line, like, this is how I can enhance your business. And you've got to think about it from that perspective. And the only way to get there is to have positive communications and a real relationship with whoever it is that you're dealing with. So relationships to me are everything.
Yep. So Zach's really good at asking those really important business questions. And I'm going to stick to my sleight of hand over here. So we can all agree that we've had that lap that just sticks with us. What's the biggest on-track mistake that you think you've ever made? And one that's kind of just stuck with you?
Ooh, there's a couple.
We've got time.
Okay. one, I mean, they're both, when you guys know, like, typically as racers, like, it's not like it's an individual sport, but for me, like, there's anything that goes wrong on my run, like, it ultimately comes back to me, right? So the two that stick out of my mind are opposite. I'll take one from a driving standpoint, and this is back, oh goodness, you're gonna get me lying on yours. I think it was 2006 when Danny Sons was doing the DragRaceResults.com nationwide bracket series, and that season Rustin Mays and I had gone back and forth for the Super Pro Championship or the Super Pro points lead throughout the season. And this is a deal that went nationwide. Like, you didn't have to go to all the races. You picked out, you know, whatever. You got your best 5 out of 8 or whatever the case was. But the season-long points champion got a turnkey dragster that, you know, at that time was probably a $45,000-$50,000 car. And keep in mind, this is 15 years ago. You know, this was a huge year-end bonus. And I don't believe, like, second place got, like, $1,500 or something. You know what I mean? It was a huge swing. And we went back and forth all season from coast to coast. Like, I chased him to Tucson, Arizona to try to block. And then when we actually paired up, it was in the final and he beat me. So that was a bad trip. But the run, that's not even the run that sticks in my mind, too. It all came down to the last race of the season was like early November at South Georgia. And on the last day, I don't even remember if Rustin had lost or maybe he couldn't even claim the round. But I staged for second round, I believe it was. All I had to do was get that win light. And I win the points championship. And I, like, you don't ever take anyone lightly. But when we counted back and I saw who I won, I'm like, oh, yes, I just won the championship. Like, it's this thing looks like it came out of Garlitz Museum. You know what I mean? It's Swamp Rat 2 in 2006. And this old guy that, like, was, you know, suited up at the trailer and drove all the way so he didn't have to get out of the car, right? And I'm like, oh, licking my chops. And it was just the adrenaline of the whole moment or whatever. Like, I thought that I wouldn't say that I was set up safe. Like, I was aggressive as usual. And I turned it red and not like 1,000. I think I was like 7 or 8 thousandths red. And it was, in retrospect, just from the intensity of the moment. You know what I mean? Like, how amped up I was, just adrenaline takes over. But that was a really, really bad feel. You know what I mean? Especially then I get the time slip and the opponent made the run that you would have expected. You know what I mean? Like, it was a really easy round to win in retrospect, had you just been green. So
659 feet of nausea.
Yes. Yeah. So that was a rough one that I'll probably never forget. Not that I don't even necessarily remember all of the details of the run. I'll never forget the feeling afterward. You know what I mean? Like, I wanted to throw. Like, it was just a complete kick in the gut. And then since, like, I think every year I take losses less and less hard. And as bad as it is to say, I think I just kind of get used to it. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
Right. So, but the one more recent, I won Indy in 15. And nobody's ever won Super Comp at Indy in back-to-back years. And in 16, I love that race. I love that whole atmosphere. Like, it's just really cool. And I've had a lot of success in that. I think I've been in on Monday 4 times, you know, which typically means you're in the semifinals. And that year following the win, I rolled through the first 5 rounds driving great and I feel really good about it. I think I got away with 1 round maybe in the quarterfinals where I missed the tree and got away with it. And I thought, okay, they let me by with that. Like, I'm winning this race. And at 4 cars on Monday, I was 005, I think. And I was running Greg Campline and he was like 27 or 30. Like, and I saw it on the tree. And as soon as we left, I said, this is over, right? I'm in the final. And when my car came off the stop, it actually sheared the 3 bolts that hold the drive shaft mandrel to the balancer. It sheared those off and spit that off, which I lost the crank trigger and the fuel pump belt is also tied to that. So I couldn't get on the racetrack. And I just, that feeling of, A, I was in the exact same lane that I was in the final the year before. So I knew what Monday at Indy is quote unquote supposed to feel like. And then knowing as I'm coasting helplessly down the track, watching his wind light come on, like knowing what the other side of that feels like, that was awful. And who knows? I'm fairly confident if that holds on that I'm in the final at Indy for the second straight year. I would have been paired with Gary Stinnett, who was unreal and has probably had more success at Indy than anyone. And he made a great run in the final. So who's to say that I would have actually come out victorious, but I sure would have liked to find out. So that's one that definitely I won't forget.
I feel like Stinnett in the other lane, I feel like you thrive off of that pressure just a little more than you would if Greg Campline in the other lane. I was sitting about 400 feet out for that. And I thought, man, I have to put gas in the car. So because I live 45 minutes south, so I usually show up to Indy on Thursday night and then come back on Monday, because Monday is where, you know, that's what it's all about for the sportsman guy. And I, you know, fuel cars are cool to watch, absolutely, but the sportsman cars, you know, that's you know, where we're at and where we came from. And, you know, I thought, man, that's just got to be, I felt sick for you.
Yeah, no, not a good, but, and of all times, you know, I mean, ultimately, like, say it's my fault. Obviously, those bolts were loose, and it's something that I didn't put a wrench on, but man, the timing.
Yeah. And it actually, I've had that happen before. It feels like the motor just lets go, really. That's sickening.
Yes.
You've kind of noted that, you know, Texas Raceway and all the names that have came out of there. What are some attributes from guys that you grew up racing with and against that you would like to instill in yourself, or some guys that, like, you know, Scotty's going to let go like a monster, you know, and give us some of the racers and kind of what they were known for back in the day?
Looking back, I, again, you don't realize it at the time because you don't know what else is going on at other tracks around the country. As I'm watching those guys, I'm 10, 11, 12 years old. But looking back, like, there was just a culture of you didn't win at Kennedale, with very, very few exception. You didn't win at Kennedale just putting a number on it and holding on the floor. You know what I mean? Like, finish line racing was a thing. And watching that, and obviously, I think it always trickles from the top down. So you're watching Scotty and Edmund, and you're watching Jeremy and Jeff Heffler, and you're watching Tommy Phillips. You know what I mean? And just the way that they went about it. And then, you know, I mean, what's the iron sharpens iron? You know what I mean? Like, when you know that you've got to beat those guys week in and week out, everybody else either does one or two things. Like, you either quit or you get better. And around there at that time, like, everybody just got better. And that's why there's so many, you know, like my generation and a little bit older. And then Austin followed me, Williams. Like, there's just been so many great racers that came out of that area. And that's the only thing that I can attribute it to, is that ultimately it was, before they moved to Tennessee, it was Scotty and Edmund setting the bar really high, and everybody else trying to figure out, like, okay, how do we get to that level, you know?
Yeah, and what do you think would happen if we packed Austin Williams up and moved him to, say, Nashville, Tennessee, and go bracket racing?
Chaos
would ensue, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, no, he would be unbelievably successful, because he's never been anything but unbelievably successful. It would be a little bit of a transition for him, because he's been so NHRA heavy, and to me, like I said earlier, like, the eighth mile bracket racing game is so much, like, to me, to win in NHRA racing requires a level of like creativity, and eighth mile bracket racing is more about discipline. So I think there'd be a little bit of a transitional phase, but yeah, like, that kid would knock it out of the park. He's unbelievable. So and to me, like, I was having this conversation earlier today about Justin Lamb. Like, I just don't think that the bracket racers, you know, on this part of the country, those two guys I'll single out, like, I don't think they give them enough credit, because they just kind of stay in their realm, so to speak. Like, Austin pretty much just runs NHRA races, same with Justin. Like, those guys are incredible and could win. If they set out to go big dollar bracket racing, like, they would be as good a pick to win the million as anybody else. Like, they're awesome.
Yeah, I agree
No different than if you took Johnny Ezell and said, we're going to enter 8 national events. Like, you know what I mean? He'd be awesome. So
yeah, it'd be he'd make it to the water box probably before he got thrown out of his first one, but it's all
Yeah, he might have some issues. There'd be some growing pains there too. But yeah,
what do you mean pants? I'm wearing pants.
These boots are SFI.
Yeah. And, you know, along the NHRA spectrum, do you think we'll ever see quarter mile bracket racing come back? Do you think it's the phase we're going through? Jerron Settles, obviously, if he ever, he'd probably just smash the 594 and 660 cones if he could, but do you think it would ever come back?
Unfortunately, no. I think it's irreversible at this point. I would love to see it. I love quarter mile racing in general. I enjoy quarter mile bracket racing, but the fact of the matter is, I think the biggest thing behind it is just the evolution and the fact that we outrun more facilities each and every year. You know what I mean? Because there's, with the exception of the mega tracks, there's a lot of, you know, quarter mile facilities, or facilities that were built as quarter mile facilities, that just don't have enough room. So they go to eighth mile, and it makes sense, and it trickles down. And there's this argument that eighth mile racing is easier on equipment. I don't know that that's necessarily the case. I think we beat ourselves up more in the burnout and going on the chip than we do that extra 2, 3, 4 seconds, you know, wide open, but whatever. I mean, there's probably a little something to that. I just, man, quarter mile racing is so much more fun. It's a big reason that I enjoy super comp and super gas racing as much as I do. But if you're asking me, like, is it going to make a comeback? I can't really envision it.
Yeah, I understand. I made one pass in my 19-inch cage hardtail race tech in like 770 to 170. It's oddly quiet from 1,000 foot on, and that's something that was definitely surprising to me. I think bracket racing at that distance would be quite a lot of fun, but I'm not sure I think I enjoy my eighth mile stuff quite a bit.
Sure. No, I mean, there's pluses and minuses to both. If you're like from a I say racing, but like a finish line driving standpoint, it just opens things up a little bit more. Plus, you just get the inherent, if you got a, you know, 150 mile an hour car eighth mile and you take it to 190, well, if you get there first a foot, it's, you know, a couple thousands closer than it was at the eighth mile, just because everybody's going faster. So in a side-by-side race, it's actually easier to look like you did a really good job quarter-mile racing, too.
Right. And quick story leading into this next question. So the first time I ever talked to Luke in my life, we were in the lanes at Beach Bend at the U.S. Open. And the week before, we were at I-57 for what I think we ran the July 4th race, or the July 3rd race, Mega Bucks. And I remember that being the most bugs I'd ever seen at a racetrack in my life, as far as like them hitting the windshield. And then the entire way home, the whole front of my trailer was coated completely with bug guts whenever I got home. And then there we find ourselves on Saturday, and I'm looking through, and we were already in, oh, probably 6th, 7th round. It was getting down to it. And there was Luke and me and Joe Davis and I think Ken Jones, that all four had raced. I think it was like a Tuesday night at I-57 and ended up Saturday, and we were all still left. And I was looking at the front of Luke's Vega, and it was still coated with bugs. Like, you couldn't even see the primer, I don't think, on the front end anymore. I remember coming up and introducing to, you know, and talking to you and kind of joking about that. And the Vega, what that's where this huge long story wraps around to. The Vega is getting some love that it has never seen before, I don't think. It was used and abused, and very, very well. I say abused. I mean, it was abused by winning a lot of races.
You can say it was abused.
Yeah, it was abused. So tell us about the Vega and what's going on. Man, I'm excited to see this finished product. And when do you think it's going to be on a track, and what all's happening? I'm seeing the paint job now. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I apologize to anybody that has been kind of following along on the Vega Resurrection blog. It hasn't been updated in months, maybe a year. And I've got a lot of ammunition there. It's on the list, so to speak. So that's going to get updated soon, and probably four or five updates within a month as I get caught up. So look for that. It'll be on thisisbracketracing.com. But no, to your point, a little history on the Vega, and this is turning into the Blake Allen podcast, because I had mentioned Blake earlier about kind of being the catalyst to get started, that, you know, ultimately started this bracket racing. But Blake is where my Vega came from. And funny story, but seems like you guys got plenty of time, so I'll share it. In 2003-04, somewhere in that time frame, I had an old 76 Nova, you guys may remember it, that I'd run in foot brake and 1090 for a while, and I had dragsters at the time. There was a big bracket race at Montgomery, and the weekend points champion got a base roller dragster, and I won the weekend points championship. I think it was called the Fistful of Dollars or something like that. So I had this, it was a Miller car, and it was like the most god-awful puke brown powder coat that you've ever seen. And I think it was a solid car. And I remember taking it home like, this is awesome, but what in the world am I going to do with this? Like, it's hideous. And it's a solid car. Like, I don't want it. I don't need it. I don't really know that I could sell it, you know?
You could have ran Compilator with it.
Yeah. So my buddy Blake starts sending me these emails of this Vega, and he's like, you need this Vega. And I'm like, what on earth do I need a Vega, right? That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. But for whatever reason, I'm looking at the emails, and this thing's growing on. And then he calls, and he's like, hey, didn't you just win a dragster? I'm like, yeah. You want to trade it for a Vega? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what else I'm going to do with it, right? So we get to talking back and forth, and as it ends up, I trade this car that I've got nothing in, you know, essentially, like I want it, and $3,500 for my Vega turnkey with a 350 in it. And I don't know if anybody remembers this, but it was painted like all it was missing was the golden arches, and I could have been sponsored by McDonald's. It was red, yellow, and blue, and when they painted it, like, they just mashed stuff off, and then it didn't get cleared or anything like that. So people talk about, like, you catch a fingernail on the stripes in the paint. Like, you could cut your finger on the stripes in the paint. But I picked this thing up. He met me somewhere. Blake's in Oklahoma, and I want to say we met in Arkansas somewhere, and I got this car and drove it in the trailer and left there and went to Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And that night, I won a $3,000 foot brake race in it. First time I'd ever set in it. And so I basically paid for the car on day one. And then it's just been, you know, a downhill ride ever since. We've got a really good history. But no, to answer your question, Zach, it is. I got done. It's been a while. It's been down now. I guess it was the end of 2016. I ran Jed's Southern Foot Brake Challenge at Holly Springs with it. And then came home, and it had blown a head gasket, and I was kind of tired of looking at how rough it had gotten. Because keep in mind, for like a decade, it served as the center support for whatever dragster I had. Like I had, it wasn't just one. I had two or three trailers that the two cars didn't really fit in. So you would back the dragster in, hoist it up, drive the Vega until it hit the dragster, close the door, hope for the best, right? Because that was all you could do. So the roof was caved in. There was duct tape holding several parts of it together. But at its core, it was a really good car. It's a full tube chassis car. It was originally a Don Hardy. It wasn't a pro stock car. It was built for modified, but it was a race car in 74, which is a 74 Vega. I've still got the tag that's on the dash from Hardy. And then over the years, I'm pretty sure that it was originally a ladder bar A-arm car. And then over the years, it's gone through transformations. This was before I got it. It got back halved, it got front halved, it got mid halved to some extent, and it's now a strut four link car. So it's always been a really good car. It just looked bad when I got it, and then it looked worse 15 years later. So anyhow, we got done with that race at the end of 16, and I think I'd raced it three times that year. I was heavy into the NHRA stuff. I had my dragster. I had my Corvette. I just didn't get much opportunity to race the Vega. And I knew that ultimately this kind of life transition was coming, where I wasn't going to be traveling racing, didn't care to continue traveling racing, was going to try to raise a family. And at that time, that's when I want my Vega, right? So if I'm ever going to make it nice, here's the window. Like, just take a year that's now turned into two, and there's going to be a little bit more than two, and make it what you want. So we stripped it out down to nothing. It's been a long time at my buddy Jeff Hayes's shop, just not necessarily getting a ton of chassis work, but just moving tabs around and getting everything the way that I wanted to get it, and fixing 40 years of abuse, right? 45 years of abuse. And we put steel doors on it. We put a steel hatch on it. Took it to Rick's in Memphis, got powder coated. And then it's actually at a buddy of mine's shop about an hour from here, T2G Customs, which is Sean Johnston. He races with us at I-57, has done all the work. And we actually, as we record this, we are supposed to go pick it up in 2 days. We're recording, it's Monday night. Wednesday, I'm supposed to pick up the Vega, and it will come back to my shop. And they have gone way over and above. Like, it's immaculate. It's going to be awesome. When it comes back here, Jeff's going to put all the carbon interior in it, and then we just start assembling it. So that was like a 10-minute rant to answer your question, Zach. I don't think it's realistic that I'll have it at Vegas. That's where I'll probably start my season in April. But my goal, my birthday is May 30th. And I hope to have it on the track by my birthday or right around that time. So that's what we're shooting for.
Like a kid on Christmas.
Yes. Oh,
2 days away.
and I don't know, like, when I die, they're going to have to dig a big hole because this is going with me. Like, nobody's ever going to give me half of what I've got in it. But that's fine. Like, that was my intention. I just, I don't see ever getting rid of it. And I want it to be what I want. And, you know, ultimately, if Gary decides he wants to go racing, this is probably what he'll start in. Like, it's going to be a family heirloom. So it's part of me.
Gary, you better enjoy it now. I die, it's going with me.
That's it.
So back to the eighth mile, quarter mile conversation, kind of the current state of bracket racing. What kind of damage, or lack thereof, so to speak, do you think will inflict in the long-term health of the sport? Because, you know, tracks like Martin, Michigan, and Rockingham and Montgomery are going to survive absolutely because they can rent the track out any time. But, you know, our local tracks, you know, you've seen it at Accelo Quarter and I-57, and, you know, it takes a beating whenever one of those races is in the area. And part of that's a promoter problem on the track's fault. You know, hey, this is probably going to take quite a bit of my racers. But what kind of damage, or if not damage, what is it doing for the long-term health of the sport?
I don't think I'm alone, Jake. And as awesome as this moment is, you know, 2018, 2019, and all of this big dollar racing, for those of us that are in the sport, that are invested, this is like the glory days, right? To get an opportunity to run for not only this kind of money, but this much buzz and everything like that. I worry about the long-term future of our sport. And it's way down the road. And we're talking 10, maybe 20 years from now, I think. I just wonder where the next generation comes from. And I know, like, people worried about that when I was a kid, and the sport's done nothing but thrive since. But the problem here, and I don't think it's necessarily, it's like what came first, the chicken or the egg, right? Because you could say this is the fault of this big dollar bracket racing scene, that the local program is dying. Or you could say that the reason that the big dollar bracket scene is so successful is because the local program is dying. You know what I mean? Like, one kind of feeds the other, and I'm not necessarily sure one overrides the other. I think we just get to a point where we have kind of priced ourselves out. It's so expensive for the most part to compete in our sport, regardless of the level, that for the average investment, like, it just doesn't make sense to go race for $1,000 on the weekend. Like, you can't hardly make 7 runs for that. You know what I mean? If you were to itemize it all out. So, but the downfall of that is that it's gotten so expensive to compete that it's just not realistic, certainly for the average, like, you know, just out of college, starting in the workforce. Like, where would you get started if it wasn't for, you know, a father or a parent or a mentor that raced? And now the biggest issue, as the big dollar side gets stronger and the local race side gets weaker, is like, where is that feeder system? Like, where are new racers that are interested gonna learn how to race? Because it's seemingly like there's not gonna be a lot of Saturday night race programs. You know what I mean? There's fewer and fewer every year. Well, your first race, can you imagine what it would be like if the first time that you ever staged for competition was in a 25 grander? You know what I mean? Like, I just don't know what that means long term for the future of our sport. It's I think we're in an interesting spot because it's so cool to just take advantage of what's available right now. But if we don't change perspective in some form and try to really appease that next generation or that grassroots racer, like, I just don't know what it means when our generation isn't able to race anymore. I don't know what comes next.
That tune, you know, it's hard to find a 76 Nova that you can buy for $2,000 and go, you know, 13 flat or something these days. You know, it's right. Not they're not making them anymore, and that's where the sport has to figure out how it's going to evolve in that aspect. I think, you know, you take a Nissan Sentra there, you're probably going to be in a whole lot of trouble,
right? Because that's, I mean, that was the foundation of bracket racing, is it's a cheaper way to compete and have fun. And now we've kind of, I mean, we've gone down the same road that class racing did in the 70s, where it's just, we priced everybody out of it. You know, I mean, that's what spawned bracket racing, but what spawns from here? You know what I mean?
Hopefully not roll racing or no prep or something.
Right.
So you've done quite a bit. I know you said that if you could never stage for another round, you'd be satisfied, but what's left on that short list?
For me, it's not necessarily an accomplishment anymore. And part of that is, like, yeah, I've done or won, like, most of the major stuff that I ever would have set out to. You know, I mean, I wanted to win Indy, I wanted to win World Championship, and then specifically, like, the Vegas Million. Like, that was kind of the last big thing. But my perspective is pivoted a little bit to where, like, I'm getting back to really enjoying the competition aspect. Like, I've always enjoyed being at the racetrack and meeting the people. And obviously, it's easier to have fun when you're winning than when you're losing. But for the longest time, like, my livelihood was rooted around racing. And when you're making a living racing, like, it's not like you're a professional basketball player. Like, those guys, certainly their income is rooted in success to some extent. But ultimately, they're entertainers. I could go race all the time. Like, nobody's going to pay to watch me, right? Like, I got to win. And so that just adds an element of pressure and stress, which isn't all bad, but it makes it more difficult to enjoy the little things of the sport. And now I'm fortunate enough to kind of, A, I'm in a better place probably financially than I've ever been. And B, you know, having kind of checked those boxes, so to speak, that now, I mean, when I go to the racetrack, I want to win. Don't get me wrong. But it just has freed me up so much more to be like, man, this is really cool to just have this opportunity to be here, specifically with my family and surrounded by really cool people in the pits, but to just embrace the competition, because that's ultimately what drew me to the sport, is just trying to figure out a way to be a little bit better than the guy or gal next to you and all the intricacies that go along with that. So I think that's kind of come full circle for me. And I would say going forward, like, it's just really being able to enjoy that competitive spirit and then to share it, you know, with my wife and ultimately with our kids. So for me, not necessarily a specific accomplishment, just really kind of soaking that in.
Yeah, I understand that completely. And you know, hopefully one day Zach and I can say, hey, we know exactly what he means by that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and I can tell you this, though. I mean, from what listening to Luke and from an instructor standpoint, anybody that is thinking about this bracket racing elite, I think you should at least try it. And because I don't think that you're going to regret it. I mean, from an instructor standpoint, Luke, as you can tell, has a great way of of putting things. And from an instructor standpoint, he's very, very easy to take instruction from. And that's one of the things I've thought of so many times. And I don't know why I never thought of it before he said it. It was one of those like aha moments of how many times now I've pulled up in the water box and no matter where I'm at or what time, I think, man, this is so cool. Like, how awesome is this to get to do this? I mean, we're so lucky to get to even participate in this sport, you know, and that's helped me so many times through big rounds and think like, okay, you've got this guy and, you know, he's won this and he's done that. And then just think, holy crap, I get the chance to race this dude. My wind light could come on. I can do this, you know, and how awesome is that? It's just a great, great perspective. So, and that's just a taste of what you would get in elite. So I encourage everybody to try it. And that kind of leads into this question, Luke, from one of our listeners. He had asked us, you know, to kind of go through the people that we were interviewing and ask him as from a perspective of somebody that has been out of the sport. This gentleman has raced before, but now is getting in after, I think he said 20 years and is going to get back into bracket racing this year. What's one thing that you could, a piece of advice that you could give, somebody that's looking to get back into the sport?
Probably similar to somebody that's just starting anew in that, you know, obviously he's got the background, he understands what's going on for the most part, but there's so much that's changed over the last 20 years that I don't really care who you are or what you do. Like, I feel like I do this or certainly try to do this. Soak up everything that you can, you know, whether it's listening to this podcast or, you know, just taking things off social media or whatever, like reading National Dragster, whatever the case may be, like soak up all the information you can, talk to people at the racetrack. And kind of along those same lines, but by far the most important is that you are not going to stage up at your first race. I mean, maybe the stars align and you win it. But if you are not a better racer in November than you are in March, like you're not doing it right. Like you should learn something every time that you go down the racetrack and every time that you go to the racetrack. So I would just say, don't be too hard on yourself because there's inevitably going to be a growth period there and a learning curve that probably never stops. And in the process of that, just be open to learning. Like I said, I don't know the number. I'm sure I've been on the racetrack 10,000 times in my life. And I would like to think that every time that I stage, I learn something new, think of something different, or at the very least reinforce something that I hadn't thought about in a long time. And I think if you go into it with that kind of curious attitude, then A, I think you enjoy it more. And B, I think you almost can't help but to improve.
Yeah. So pretty much take everything that you remember from 20 years ago, other than the length of the track and the 5/10 amber tree, and just throw it away. start new.
It's amazing, like when you think back to that, even just my mindset 20 years ago to what it is today, you know what I mean? Like it's incredible because it's the same game, but it has just evolved so much. And it was probably like that, you know, from what would that be, like 1975 to 1995? It was certainly like that. But it just
I was
seems
like two then, so
right. Yeah, I mean, just watching it evolve and thinking back to what we thought, you know, in the mid 90s or the late 90s, now I guess 20 years ago, to what it is today, it's amazing how far we've come.
Oh yeah, so, I remember thinking back then, what, 20 years ago, I'm watching my dad race Super Pro and thinking, you've heard somebody had a better than a 10 package. I was like, wow, what? Like that doesn't, I mean, it just doesn't happen. And now it's just, you know, I mean, 10 to 15 better packages is all day long. If you're not there, it's bad. You're getting hurt.
What we thought then was, man, they almost screwed that up. That
right.
Thread. You know, I mean, that was almost under. And now it, you know, it's just so commonplace. It's incredible. It's funny. I remember, you remember the old NHRA Today shows?
No,
TNN back in the, okay. Well, I'm really showing my age. But every now and then Bob Fry would do like a sportsman special. And I remember he did this special on like how to bracket race, you know, like for somebody that's never done it before. And what he said, me and my dad would watch this every, whatever it was, Saturday morning, Sunday morning, whenever they came on. And what he said was, well, you just go, you make your three time trials, and then you got to select a dial in for first round. So what I would recommend is just take the average of those three runs. And my dad and I looked at each other and we're like, he's crazy. Like, you can't do that. You're going to break out. Like, you take the fastest and then you dial down one or two. Because if you break out, you lose. And I mean, I ain't that old. You know what I mean? That's 25 years ago. Like, that's the way we thought. So, yeah.
Now you hear three or four total. It's like, yeah, he did that on purpose. Yeah, he knew it. He knew what he was set up to be one. Yeah. So on a little bit lighter note, much like you guys do at the Sportsman Drag Racing Podcast, give me a Texas Raceway story that you'll never forget, but you really don't want to remember. Something that maybe would have went down that you know, because you know, there's got to be, with the likes of Scotty and Edmund and Heffler and everybody there, that's a heck of a crowd to be around. It's like trying to hang out at the FTI camp on a bracket race weekend.
There was so much good stuff there. I could tell you stories for days, but I'll out rest his soul. I'll out Tex, old man Heffler. The marquee race at Kennedale when I was growing up was called the Labor Day Landslide. It was, I think it was 3 10 granders Saturday, Sunday, Monday of Labor Day weekend, and it was the last day, so it was Monday, and I had lost. I'm sitting on the fence watching, and Jeremy Heffler had lost. We're sitting on the tailgate of his truck watching the last 10 grander. And maybe it was 2 5s and a 10, like this was the marquee race. Whatever the case was, it was the last day, and it was the biggest purse. And Tex, old man Heffler, Jerry Heffler, was they had a, you know, a super pro class as the 10 grander, and then they had, they called it no electronics. It was a foot brake class, and he was running both of them in this old 56 shoebox station wagon. And we watched him lose in no electronics, and Jeremy thought he was out. And Tex come over to us with his time slips and was like, "Hey, what do I need to dial? You know, what do you think I should do here?" And Jeremy's like, "What do you're out?" I'm like, "No, I'm still in Super Pro." "Oh, what did I miss? Did you? We've been sitting here. Did you run last round?" "Yeah, I won." "Wow, how'd I miss that?" Right. So whatever, he goes up there and runs. Well, they announce over the PA there is 64 cars remaining. There will not be another buy round. Okay, cool. So you know, we're sitting there watching, just taking it all in, and they run the round and Tex wins. And at the end of the round, they give a buy round. That's weird. There wasn't a buy round. Somebody must have not showed up, right? So go back at now there's, you know, what should be the round of 32, and Tex wins. And at the end of the round, they give a buy round. That's weird. They said there wasn't going to be any more buy rounds, and they give them two buy rounds in a row. So whatever, we have not put it together, right? We're just watching that. Well, they call up the round of 16, and at this point, they can realize, like, there are 17 calls. So everything stops. And we don't, there's no, we're still sitting at the finish line, so we have not heard anything, like, no idea what's going on. Finally, I turn to Jeremy, I'm like, "Why are they not racing? What's going on? You know, it's late Monday night. People got to go to work tomorrow. What are we doing?" And we've been down for 20, 30 minutes. And Jeremy goes, "I guarantee you they realized my dad didn't run fourth round." Like, you know, whatever. We start laughing. So, well, sure enough, Jerry Heffler went into the tower. Jerry Heffler tower. Oh, okay. So, and keep in mind, like, Tex, there may or may not have been a little bit of alcohol involved, right? I don't know. I mean, he was going mid sevens. So not that that's okay, but whatever. Like, there may or may not. So they call Tex to the tower, and I can just picture that. You know, I mean, we've been there for 3 days. He's run two classes a day. He's got pockets full of time slips, right? And they say, "Tex, our run sheet here, we don't show where you ran fourth round." "Oh, yeah, I ran fourth round." "Do you have the time slip?" "Yeah, yeah, it's right here." That's fifth round. "Okay, it's right here." "Yeah, that's third round, Tex." "What's one here?" That's fourth round of no electronics from Saturday. We need fourth round of Super Pro for today, right? Well, obviously, Tex cannot produce time slip, so he ultimately gets thrown out. Well, then it gets really good, because now what do? He's beat two people the last two rounds, right? So they end up, like, they literally stopped somebody as he was pulling out the gate and said, "Whoa, man, you're still in." And they made the two cars that he had beat run each other for a berth then in the round of 16, which then made it 17 and added around. It was a mess. And I have no idea to this day. Like, I don't remember who won that race. I don't remember what happened after that. I just remember them calling Tex to the tower and saying, "Hey, man, you didn't run round."
And what more can you do other than make those guys rerun? You know, as a promoter, there's no real winner there.
Yeah, I've thought about that since, and I'm like, I don't know how you're supposed to handle that situation, but that's how they did it. So.
Well, Luke, I'm going to throw one at you that you threw at me whenever I was on your show, since I know that, well, and all of us, you know, are interested in college hoops. So now that the seasons went a little way, I mean, I think when you asked me, they were just at the very beginning. What would you going to pick for your final four this year?
Okay. I think Duke's the class of the field. So, and I know you probably don't want to hear that at all, but I'm going to go. I
don't want to hear it, but I know what my eyes.
Yeah, right. I'll take a really ACC heavy Final Four. Give me Duke. Give me Virginia. I think they're the only team that can really hold a candle to Duke. I actually really like what your Tar Heels have done lately, and I think that they're due for a run. So I'll put three ACC teams in the Final Four. And then I'll go off the grid a little bit. I don't know if the surrounding talent around him will allow this, but if you have seen Ja Morant from Murray State, that kid is a beast. like unbelievable. He didn't even play the second half when they came to SIU. Not that SIU is good, but he had like 24 and 12 in the first half. I mean, he's just ridiculous. So I'll go like way off the grid. I'll take Murray State to make a run to the Final Four team.
Nice. I think as of right now, I would pick the same, except for I'm kind of going chalk almost, because I'm saying Tennessee looks really good.
You're right.
So a real quick question, and you can give a one word if you want to. Have you ever lost a bracket race at I-57?
Yeah. There was, when I first moved up here, there was a span, and it was actually, well, when Jess and I started date, because I'd come up here and race occasionally, you know, for that year or so before I moved up here. But there was a span there that might have spanned like 2 years. And granted, I wasn't out there every week. And when I did go, I'd enter all three classes. But I went like a year and a half, 2 years before I ran a Saturday night at I-57 where I didn't win one of the classes. But since then, they have made up for lost time, and they pretty routinely beat me like a drum for the last 3 or 4 years. So yeah,
that place is just a hotbed, though. I mean the names that run there on a weekly basis, the Bryants and the Ellises, and holy cow.
I have a knack for picking really ridiculous places to call home.
Yeah. I guess so.
I think you've had a little bit of a hand in that now for sure, as far as picking it up. But yeah, I mean, the few regular Saturdays that I did make it and ran local, I went there quite a bit. Well, you know, this year a few times, and yeah, it was just every bit as competitive for, you know, $1,000 to win as a $25,000 race. I think I was 10 around there and in the way. I think Larry McCaleb did that to me actually. But yeah, it was it's very, very competitive. So yeah, and as far as another lighter question for me, I mean, you know, this weekend we got to talk about it some. I mean, Super Bowl is coming up. I don't know if you're interested in it or not, but who you got in the Super Bowl?
Oh goodness, now, I don't follow football like much at all. Like, I'm probably the only red-blooded American that couldn't care a whole lot less. But I will say this, I root for excellence, so which is make I think I'm unique in that regard. Like, most people would always root for the new thing or the upset. So just from that standpoint, like, I'll root for New England and Brady, just to, like, I'd like to see him win five in a row. You know what I mean? I like excellence, so that's where I'd go.
Yeah, it's I keep trying to think about how it couldn't happen, and I can't make it not happen. I mean, if the Rams win, to me, I'm a Colts fan, so the Colts Patriots rivalry, I kind of have a hard time rooting for them. But Brady to Gronk is I don't know. Good luck. He's too big. He's too strong. And you just throw it up to Gronk, and he's going to grab it, and that's going to be it.
That's Kobe and Shaquille O'Neal. What relevance is?
Yeah.
So I listened to the first, I don't know, 100 episodes of the Sportsman Drag Racing podcast pretty religiously, and I might have missed this, but where did the name Cool Hand come from?
That actually, I mean, obviously it goes back to the movie. There's an old classic movie, Cool Hand Luke, was Paul Newman, but I got saddled with it by a guy you guys are probably familiar with, because he's on the Big Dollar Bracket Tour pretty regularly now, Brad Taylor out of Texas. Brad and I used to frequent a little place called Paris Drag Strip, was our Friday night drag strip when I was growing up. And he, out of the blue, I mean, I was 15, 16 years old, and he just started calling me Cool Hand Luke. And my dad liked it, so I liked it. And the next thing you know, we had on that old piece of junk Nova that I was talking about earlier, it had Luke on the window, and then stuck to the inside of the glass, you know, like the cool pro stock numbers behind it, was Cool Hand. And it's just stuck with me ever since. So, but yeah, Brad Taylor, to my knowledge, where that came from as it applied to me.
It's not accurate, but yeah, I was always curious to where you exactly picked that up. And strike me dead if you ever heard this before, but if you could be any animal, what would it be?
If anybody should be prepared for this question, it should be me. Shoot.
Yeah, I think Jess asked everybody but you.
Would it be
that kind of animal?
Yeah, right. That's a good pick. No, I think I'd be something with wing. It's maybe like an eagle or something like that. Like, flying seems cool. So yeah, I think I'd go that route.
Nice. Well, I think that's a good point to wrap it up on. Luke, thank you so much. You know, you've been awesome to me. Every endeavor that I've went with, you know, anytime I've asked you, you've always been helpful, and I really certainly appreciate that. Thank you so much for coming on Dialed In and talking to us. We really appreciate it. Appreciate your time. I know you're very busy. So thank you very much, and wish you all the luck in the world for 2019 and beyond.
Hey, same to you guys. Thank you so much for having me. And I am such a huge fan of you guys in general and what you're doing here with the podcast. You guys are awesome, and keep it up.
Yeah. Hey, not all heroes wear capes. There's no need to start now, buddy.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Luke. Have a good one, buddy. Tell Jess and Gary, and the name escapes me in the new one. The baby.
Jack.
Tell
them baby hello. Jack.
That's right. Baby Jack. Jack. Grandpa Jack is what that named after, right?
Yes, sir.
Yep, absolutely. Well, tell them always said hey, and hopefully you're enjoying your new year. We'll see you around.
All right. Thank you, fellas.
See you, Luke.
Thank you.
So, Zach, that was one heck of an interview with Cool Hand Bogacki, and, you know, that guy is a wealth of knowledge and a wealth of stories. Obviously, he definitely has stories to tell, and they're very very interesting to guys like you and I, and I think the listeners will certainly enjoy that.
Yeah, it was an awesome time. I mean, any time that you're around somebody like that, Luke, and how great he is, all the things that he's done, I mean, it just kind of soak up everything he says like a sponge is what I try to do, and he obviously is very well spoken and a wealth of knowledge. That was awesome. I certainly enjoyed that interview very much, and that was great having him on the show. And with that, here's a word from our friends at Flicker Promotions about the Southern Big Buck Nationals.
Hi, this is Cody Pollard with Flicker Promotions. Just want to tell you all about the 6th Annual Southern Big Buck Nationals, February 8th through the 10th at No Problem Raceway, Belrose, Louisiana. There will be an all-run 3-grander. Friday night, box and no box will be separated till 8 cars or less. Box weekend entry is $375, which includes two 10s. The no box weekend entry is $175, which includes two 3-granders. There will be a 64-car box shootout for $10,000, no box 32-car shootout for $2,500. If anybody has any questions, please contact me, 225-776-6818. Or make sure you like us on Facebook at Flicker Promotions.
So, Zach, for our In Motion Solutions final round discussion, it's not much of a discussion as much as it is a breaking news. It's the gift that keeps on giving. You know, we set out this contest with Jeff Lambert and race car sponsorships and whatnot, and we said that originally we're going to pick one winner. One winner is going to receive a free proposal from Lambert as well as some things that he's got worked up for whoever wins us automatically, but we couldn't pick just one, so we kind of narrowed it down to two, and we'll pull them up here, and we'll kind of talk about them just a little bit, kind of let us know what's going on with that. I know you talked to Jeff earlier in the week about this.
Yeah, you know, and Jeff is a generous guy, and he had a good idea, and so we're going to run with it. And first of all, I want to say thanks. Before I announce who got picked, I want to say thank you to everybody that took part in the contest. We certainly appreciate your participation and appreciate you guys winning, you guys participating, and you know, and like I said, just because you didn't win, you know, I just hope that it was a good experience for you. You know, to do that and to fill out that questionnaire. You know, unfortunately that, you know, we only could narrow it down to two. I wish that we could give out more free stuff, but just thank you for everybody that did participate. So we got it narrowed down to two. And so we're going to tell you who they are, and then we're going to tell you what we're going to do. So first, we're going to Rob Fisher, Rain Man.
Yeah.
So bottom bulb runner, foot breaker, middle bulb, whatever he, you know, Rob's the man. Rob, you're picked. Congratulations. Number two, Brandon Barker, Canadian, awesome guy, great driver.
There's no easy sledding north of the border.
No.
It's tough sledding up there.
Up and comer for sure in this sport. You guys are the two that we're going to pick, and here's what we're going to do. You are going to be sponsored by racesponsorships.net, which is Jeff Lambert's company, and the Dialed In podcast. And for that sponsorship, what you will receive is a racesponsorship.net proposal done professionally by Jeff Lambert. We figure that way it's a win-win for everybody. You guys, congratulations. Thank you for participating in this, and we're very glad to have you on board, and hope that, you know, this proposal and any experience that you get out of this is going to help you on the marketing front of drag racing for years to come.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not that there's an honorable mention in there to Justin Wanamaker. He made the final three, and we ultimately just put our minds together, and there's nothing wrong with Wanamaker's, but we feel like there was just a little more on the other two. Certainly two guys and three guys, for that matter, that completely deserve every bit of it. It's hard, you know, for Brandon Barker to get any kind of recognition whatsoever because the races in Canada are well covered in Canada, but you don't really see what goes on here. You know, racing up there is a whole different world. You know, you're on a ladder from round one on. You know who you race every round. You got to go on the internet, pull up the ladder, see who you race. And, you know, it's just a complete different world. And, you know, and that dude finished first and third in the Canadian Bracket Super Tour last year. And that's tough to do because, you know, you can't. It's six or seven races at five different tracks. It's not something that it's not like a national championship here where, you know, you run 14 races and you pick your best so many out of, you know, 14, it's, you know, you've got one shot at it, and every round counts, and he's made the absolute best of it. And I think that's a guy that absolutely deserves every bit of recognition that he will get from this. And I think he will definitely put it to very good use. As far as Rob Fisher goes, that's another guy that's just been doing it forever and just deserves it. He's a guy that his race cars are, I mean, they're awesome exactly for what he wants them to do. But he's never been 450 or he never goes to a $100,000 race. You know, he wins just about every weekend at his local track, and he goes down to the Southern Footbreak Challenge, and, you know, he wins 20 rounds throughout the whole weekend. And you know, I think that just a little more push, he gets over that hump and he starts, you know, being the Lucas Walker and the Nick Hastings. I think he's completely capable of that. So I think it's an excellent opportunity from Jeff Lambert. And I think that these two guys will make the absolute best of it.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you know, and not to just to make sure everybody understands, I mean, the way that this was picked is based on the answers to those questionnaires. As far as from a marketing standpoint, who had the most to offer a potential sponsor that could help them grow their business. I mean, that's where they come from. It ain't, you know, it's not wins and losses. You know, obviously, you know, on-track success helps because that helps the marketing partner get seen and on a winning car. But like we've been preaching, just like Luke said earlier, like our last three guests in a row has got to feel like they've been, you know, beating everybody over the head with it. But that's what it comes down to, is what do you have to offer from a business standpoint and from a marketing standpoint to the potential sponsor. And congratulations to Rob and Brandon. I think you guys are going to be the excellent ambassadors, you know, for racesponsorships.net and Dialed In. And so yeah.
I'm going to add on to that real quick. If you want to be mad at anybody that didn't get picked, just be mad at Jeff Lambert. He can take it.
We'll put the heat on him.
Yeah, to be completely transparent, the way this process worked was you guys submitted all those apps to Jeff. Jeff filtered through them. He came to us and he said, hey, you know, there's three or four that I thought were really good, and let's talk about it. And, you know, and that's exactly what happened. And, you know, I think at four people, we had Barker, Blaze Rea, Wanamaker, and Rob Fisher. And those, and we looked at all the apps that he threw out, and he was right on course with it. You know, that you have to be willing to put effort into it to get something out of it. And that's what Jeff's been striving for and trying to preach the whole time is, you know, you can't just say, hey, man, give me some money, I'll put a sticker on my car. That's not a whole lot of effort whatsoever. I think that's exactly where the topic was trying to head towards that direction, and those guys executed it to a T. So congratulations to Brandon and Rob, and Rain Man, I'm sure he listens every week for sure, because he tells me all the time what I do wrong. So I think that'll put a bow on episode 20, though. We'll see you guys around here in the staging lanes. Racing season's right around the corner. We don't have to hear us gas bag, as Luke would say, for a whole lot longer.
Yeah, that's right. We'll have some a lot more racing to talk about soon. So good luck, everybody, getting your stuff put together. Let's all get ready to go. March is going to be here in a couple times after we go to sleep. We'll be waking up, and it's going to be March 1st, and it's going to be here. So I'm excited and getting ready to go. So 20 episodes, Jake. Awesome. Great job. Hey, thank you. Thank you all. Thanks to Jenna. Thanks to Kristen for all the hard work that they do on this podcast. You know, we are the numbers are racking up. We're getting up there, and man, it's been a fun ride. We certainly appreciate everybody listening.
Yeah, and as far as the couple more sleeps wake up, it's going to be racing season. Let's just look over the fact that the high in our area Wednesday is 0 degrees. So it's all good.
I'm not looking at that. I'm just looking past that, because I think by the weekend it's already going to be back up to 50. So it just be a temporary day, and you know, I'll just be happy on the fact that I work inside. So to all that that work outside, man, I'm sorry. It's wear an extra set of coveralls, I guess.
Here's to being sick next week. We'll see you all guys episode 21 next week. Thank you.
Bye.